Blog Talk Radio.
I especially want young adults to listen and download today's show. It will help connect the words in the history books with one woman who experienced it firsthand. Everyone knows about the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but an impressive 250,000 people heard his I Have a Dream speech live on the Washington Mall that hot summer day in August 1963. Many more watched with anticipation on television. The rest have read about it in the history books. A very young Sema Lieberman was one of the lucky ones who heard the speech live amongst the crowds on the Washington Mall on that fateful day in 1963. And to prove to be a life-changing experience for her and countless others, we're going to talk to her about what it meant to be there, to experience it as a young person, and to hear about how that dream probably has a lot of significance for us today. Sema is my special guest today, and she will help paint the picture of why the King dream matters as much today as it did almost 50 years ago. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hello, this is Carol Copeland Thomas, and we are very glad that you have joined us today. I know there are lots of activities going on this week, this being the birth celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King. We paid tribute to him last week along with Dr. Ralph David Abernathy, and we encourage you to go back and download that show at your convenience. I'm also very excited because in 2 weeks, we are going to have our Black History Breakfast. This is the 19th breakfast event that my company has held since 2000, 12 years. Can you really believe it? And we backed it up a couple of months. We typically have this event in May, but decided to have it in February to commemorate Black History Month and bring up one of the pioneers who can tell us what it was like at the very beginning, not the March on Washington, which was like 12 years later, but what it was like in 1954, 1955, 1956, in Birmingham, Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama, Atlanta, all across the South, to begin this groundbreaking grassroots, very scary, dangerous, life-threatening civil rights movement. We're talking about Juanita Jones Abernathy, who is the widow of Dr. Ralph David Abernathy, Dr. King's best friend, closest associate in the civil rights movement. She is going to be my special guest on February 2nd. She is actually a lifelong friend of mine. I am privileged to have to call her my friend of 40 years. And we're going to hear it from her. We're going to hear about what those experiences were like, what women had to endure, what children did, what people did to really risk their jobs, their life savings, all the things that they did so that many of us can have our chief diversity officer roles. We can have our vice president jobs. We can be director of, executive director, president of all of these titles that we have because of the civil rights movement and certainly because of people like Juanita Jones Abernathy. We want you to come out. We're going to have a great crowd. The tickets are going swiftly. We have wonderful sponsors who are jumping on board, and we want you to be there as well. You can go to mssconnect.com. That's www.mssconnect.com. Learn all about it. We are especially appreciative of the Commonwealth Compact being one of our very first persons to jump on board. Give us the space. Partner with us with this very important endeavor, and all of the other sponsors who I will list in the coming weeks as the list continues to grow. But we want you to find out more about that, so we're going to continue this whole journey down the civil rights path, looking at ways that we can connect when we look at our racial similarities and differences, ways that we can look at gender issues and all of the other equations related to diversity and what it means to work, to play, to live, to exist, to work in collaboration with others down this journey. And one of those folks who I've known for a decade plus through the National Speakers Association, and I admire all the things that she does out in the San Francisco area, and was really surprised and excited to find out she was actually there on August 28, 1963, when that march on Washington took place on that very hot day. Sema Lieberman, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, I know
you were surprised because you didn't know I was that old.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier before the show, and I told you that as a 10-year-old, I was at the march that took place in Detroit when Dr. King came, and I just remember the crowds. I remember all the people there. And as many people do, he was sort of rehearsing the speech. So the I Have a Dream speech took place in Detroit and other cities as a build-up to what took place in Washington, D.C. But you were in D.C. So give us, I know that was like almost 50 years ago. Give us some firsthand impressions about what the experience was like on that day.
Well, I have to give you my experiences from like the age I was. I might think differently now, of course, so I don't know.
Right.
All I remember, we were in a few buses. We came from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And as we pulled in, this image is just in my brain forever, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All these people. I'd never seen so many people before.
Mm.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
Mm.
Black people and white people. And people and people of other cultures, but I mean, mainly I saw black people and white people, but there were, I mean, a lot of other people that I saw too,
right?
And just welcoming us into their city, and people were just standing on the sidewalks, like thousands of people on each sidewalk from the street, like we used to call it, the gutter to the buildings,
Just lined, people
in,
lined everywhere.
And people were just waving. And all I remember is just the waving as we pulled in. And I remember I'd never gotten chills from anything before.
Mm-hmm.
But the feeling that I got, I just remember the chills and the incredible feeling I got seeing all these different people together waving, welcoming people. And the feeling that day was such a feeling of unity that we are all here for the same goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we heard the speeches, I didn't understand all the speeches because I was young.
Yeah, I mean,
but
you were,
I felt the feeling
12,
of the speeches.
Right, you were 12
yeah.
years old, but I'm sure I understand what you're saying just because I remember all those crowds in Detroit. I mean, I was from Detroit, so it was just a matter of catching the bus downtown with my uncle who was up from Columbus, Georgia, visiting with us. But again, I just remember all of those crowds that were there, and I don't remember much else, but just the
right.
significance of being around so many people was, I'm sure from your point of view, 250,000 on the Washington Mall and probably a couple of thousand more, many thousands more, around lining the streets, looking for new answers and certainly inspiration from this important, powerful leader.
It was so inspiring because I had never had, like, my parents were not, like, weren't active in any way. They really didn't even talk politics that much at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I went really for personal reasons. Because I had, before
now,
that,
go,
about,
you,
I don't know.
Did you go
several,
by yourself? Or, I, you
no,
go
no,
by
I went.
12 years old.
I went to an overnight camp.
Uh-huh.
And people from the overnight camp were organizing buses of people to go.
Okay.
And so, I mean, you had to get your parents' permission if you were young. And that's how we got there.
Wow.
It was the thing. The another thing too about that day was the optimism.
Mhm. Mhm.
That I had that day. I mean, it did. It changed my life because I saw what could be possible. I saw that it wasn't just about one person trying to make a change or two people trying to make a change. And I had seen. I'd watched television, and I had a friend whose father was a freedom rider.
Mm-hmm.
And I had. And so I had heard all these stories,
Right.
And but I really never knew
Let me explain to the listeners, because some of them may not know what Freedom Riders are or were. These were mostly young people who earlier that year and prior to that got off their college campuses, went to Mississippi, went to places like Alabama, and conducted nonviolent marches and protests because of the civil rights movement being so important to them. And it's important because they were young people. They were 18 years old, 19 years old, 20 years old, and were preparing to go to jail and preparing to be beaten. So they literally went through training in terms of how to respond so that they would remain in their nonviolent manner as they were being accosted. Which, can you imagine, Sima, how frightening that was when you have dogs and hoses and people beating on you and you cannot fight back? Those are the freedom fighters, and they were forerunners to the March on Washington.
I think about that. I can't imagine. I think about people getting beaten. I think about, like, Goodman Schwerner and Cheney, Viola Liuzzo, and all these other people who were killed during that time. Because not only were people beaten, but people were murdered. Yeah. And especially if you were a black person, I mean, I have friends who had people in their family who were murdered for trying to vote.
It's riveting, and I remember, again, I think Viola died in 1965, and I was like 12 at that time. She was from the Detroit area. It was such a sad time, and I remember reading about it. You know, my parents subscribed to the newspaper, and you heard about it on television, and it was just it was horrible because that was one of us, somebody from our area. She was a housewife, but she went down there to make a stand and got killed for it. So back to the march. I want to go back to the march and just sort of painting the picture. I think it's important, too, to have you on this show. I'm growing increasingly concerned about our young people of all stripes who are becoming detached from this important movement. I'm also becoming concerned about professionals, particularly professionals of color and black professionals, who don't understand the relevance of the civil rights movement and all of these activities that literally paved the way for them to have their jobs today. I mean, I'm having some interesting conversations with people because of their busy schedules, and they can or they can't really come to the breakfast on February 2nd because they're busy. And I mentioned to one person in all love and respect, I said, do you realize that Dr. King, Dr. Abernathy, Juanita Jones Abernathy sacrificed so that you can have your job, the job that you have today? So I look at the significance of what we're doing and where we are today across the globe. I'm looking at the chat room. I've got guests in the chat room. My buddy from Liverpool, England, is in the chat room, Garth Dallas. I mean, I look at the sacrifice of people during that era who made a way for what we're doing today. And can you help us to draw the connection between you as a 12-year-old with other campers during that era, taking a bus to Washington, D.C., participating in that march, and what it was like and how significant it is for us today, Sima Lieberman?
It's significant in a lot of areas because, for one, as you said, if it wasn't for those marchers, if it wasn't for that movement, black people would still be drinking out of separate water fountains. White people would still be, if you were a white person, you would, I mean, not that all this doesn't go on still, but you have more interaction. You have more people relating to each other. You have more people working with each other. You have more people working on goals that may not be related to anything to do with civil rights, but it wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for that. And one thing I remember is that one of the reasons why I went was for personal reasons, in that I had had when I had had like two black friends, and I remember one of them was, and I remember one was I can't remember, in elementary school, and I was passing by Woolworths one day, and I saw people walking up and down. I'll never forget this. 1, 2, 3, 4, don't go in here anymore. 2, 4, 6, 8, Southern Woolworths, segregate. And I thought, what's going on? And they told me what was happening. So black people in the South can't sit at lunch counters. And I just thought, well, that would mean my friend Edith can't sit at a lunch counter. Well, then I better march with these people. And then later on, when I was in sixth grade, I got put into a junior high school, into an accelerated class. There were like a bunch of us who got put into this accelerated class where you skipped the eighth grade. And you went through seventh, and you skipped eighth, and you went to ninth. And there was a really good friend of mine, a young girl. Her name was Dana McBroom. I've talked about her a lot. I'm still in contact with her. And she was in the accelerated class. She was the only black kid in the accelerated class. And in the after the seventh grade, she was kicked out of that class. The only one kid was kicked out of the class, and it was Dana, who was brilliant. And we've talked about this, and she talks about the racism that she endured during that time. And so when I heard about the March on Washington, that was another thing that spurred me to go, because I was seeing some of these things, and I said, okay, if this is happening to my friends, then I need to do something about it. And I think what happens today, people take things for granted. I think that there's that people always say, oh, young people are so progressive, blah, 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 blah. Well, okay, it's true. You could go down the street. You could be in an interracial relationship. People aren't going to stare at you. You could sit down and eat with people from different cultures. That's true. But people don't really understand each other's cultures. And when you look at who's starting a lot of these small businesses, a lot of these high-tech businesses, a lot of it is, not putting it down, but a lot of it's like young white guys from Ivy League schools, which is great, but the thing is that people bring in who they know. And if you do not have those relationships, if you do not have contact with people who are different than you, that's all who you're going to bring in. And
well, I mean,
think that people...
That's the main
ahead.
Message. That's the main message in terms of trying to break up these tribes. I mean, we're all tribal, we're all cultural, so we tend to connect with people who are like us. But I mean, the whole message of the civil rights movement, diversity, multiculturalism, and the like, inclusion, is to sort of foster a connection with people who are like you and who are different than you are. That's the whole significance of it. I wanted to mention we have in the chat room Garth Dallas from Liverpool, England, and he's a fan of yours. He has read your articles online, and he is really, really glad to connect with you here on Blog Talk Radio. Yeah.
Oh, I've been wanting to talk to him.
Yeah. Well, he's in the chat room.
Hi, Garth.
Yep. I'm sure you heard that, Garth. That's great. So, you know, I think it's pretty significant, and this again is what young people and young professionals need to know, and those who were born outside of the United States, that when you look at the civil rights movement, you are not just looking at black people. Yes, you are looking at the injustice being overturned for black people and Latinos during that time, and ultimately Asian Americans, but the work was done by a multicultural group. Certainly lots of whites financed the movement. There were many different ethnic groups that participated. You had Harry Belafonte, entertainers.
Oh, yeah.
Who were actively involved, and then we had Sima Lieberman, who's Jewish. So what was the experience like for you as a young Jewish woman being a part of this and then obviously taking this on as one of your professions?
You know, I was asked this actually when I was on another radio show. I think for me, and this might sound a little cliche, but this is what I was going through at that age, I had friends whose families had been in the concentration camps. Or they'd been killed in the Holocaust. And it was a very fearful time for me. And it was a very fearful time for Jewish people because the war had not been over that long. And I remember at an early age thinking that and I looked at the hate, because we'd had some anti-Semitic incidents where people throw rocks at us in synagogue. And I remember thinking, how could people hate people that they don't know? And I remember thinking that as a Jewish person, if we were going to survive, it was really important to be able to have relationships with people who were different than us, and that we need to get to know them and they need to get to know us. And I think that And so as a result, I really developed a curiosity about people who were different. I remember my friend Dana, her family was from Montserrat, and I never knew anybody from anywhere.
Right.
And it was just, and I was just always wanted to know. I wanted to go to people's houses. I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to be friends. But I also wanted them to know me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so at an early age, I started feeling part of something that was greater than myself.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
when I went to that march and when I did other actions, it was because of people that I knew personally. I thought, I feel part of them. And that if this is happening to other people, that there's in a certain way it's happening to me because it's happening to people that I know personally and that I love and I care about. And then mm-hmm. I started seeing it as a much larger movement, as a bigger movement. And that's really what got me into diversity. I mean, mm-hmm. My life went on a lot of different paths, a lot of self-destructive paths. And one of the things that got me back on course was knowing that where I was going on a self-destructive path was in collision with what my values were.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
that's what helped move me more to get into work in diversity and to do dialogues. We did a lot of dialogues between black people and white people, between Jewish people, African-American people, Puerto Rican people,
mm-hmm.
and just to be able to bring people together. Because what I saw in Washington was people coming together. And I don't see people coming together in the same way anymore.
I think you mentioned two things. Number one, on that day, you're 12, you're on a bus, you're there with other campers. Obviously, they're adults. They're supervising you. And two things that run into your head. Number one, how warm and inviting the Washingtonians are to you and the others who are coming in for that significant day. And number two, you are thinking as a young person about the Holocaust and how the Holocaust
yes.
impacted you. So
exactly.
Clearly that has to have resonated through your heart during that time. Let me ask a question. This is a question from Garth. He says, how far does Sima believe that the MLK dream has been realized in 2012 America? That's a great question.
That's a great question. I don't know, because I think that his dream would have continued.
Hmm.
Because if you would say the dream is to get rid of segregation, of like legalized segregation, I'd say yes, from what I know, that's happened. But then I see other ways in which we have a long way to go. So I think that if King was still alive, he'd be looking at where do we go next? What do we do further? Because remember, when he was killed, he'd gotten the garbage strikers. He had started working with them, and they were not
mm-hmm. –
yes, and it was white people. Like mm-hmm. he started getting people together from different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I hear people, I have friends who say, oh, things haven't changed. Well, yeah, they have changed. Of course they've changed. But it's not over. And I think that there's a misconception when people think that it's over. Maybe it's over from their point of view because nothing's happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if it's not happening to me, it's not happening. But mm-hmm. in reality, it's still happening. There's still a lot of issues that are not resolved. There's still a lot of de facto racism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all you have to do is just watch and pay attention, as I am and you certainly are, the 2012 elections, the presidential elections.
Oh.
Look at the candidates, look at the rhetoric, look at the reactions of the crowd, the debate that they had in South Carolina earlier this week, and Juan Williams, who was a black conservative Fox News commentator who was there asking questions, asked the question of Gingrich, was it Newt Gingrich, I believe, and the response that the audience yelled back, and it was just, when you look at the rhetoric that is said, the response of the crowds, the kind of presidential campaign that is being conducted, the disrespect for President Obama, we have a long way to go, a long way.
There's a disrespect for President Obama, and what I think is really horrible is that it's become accepted.
Yes.
There's a lot of people
yes.
who accept that disrespect. I think it's the same disrespect if you look at how people who are immigrants, like Spanish-speaking immigrants, the way that they're treated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
that people think They think, okay, schools aren't segregated anymore. Okay, people can work at the same jobs. That means everything else we do is okay. What are you complaining about? There's no segregation. We could say anything we want. We could disrespect. We could say all black people are on food stamps or all black people are on welfare whatever it is that people are saying, and they think that that's okay.
Right. Well, I heard today, I mean, literally today on one of the news programs, I watch MSNBC all the time, and a South Carolinian who was firmly for, these are his words, Speaker Gingrich, referring to Newt Gingrich, and then when he referred to the other Republican candidates and our president, they were called by their last names, Romney, Obama, but it was Speaker Gingrich.
Right.
So that, those micro inequities, those little things, you and I are seeing all the time, and they are, as you're saying, it's accepted and it's not challenged, and that is, that to me, that's the outcry that didn't take place during the civil rights movement. People stood up finally, not everybody, but those who were bold and courageous stood up, and they put their lives on the line to say, no, this is not going to be tolerated.
And I think that part of that too is that I want to, there are some people I just want to say, how many African American or people have you actually had an in-depth conversation with? You know, you think you know people, but you really don't. And maybe you know one person who agrees with you, and that's like the one black person that you know. But how many people of different cultures have you ever really sat down with? Have you ever really gotten to know? Have you ever been willing to look and see how another person sees things through their experience? And I think that is
the big question.
Morally lacking.
Yeah, that's a big question. I think it's easier for all of us to hang on to our stereotypes, our assumptions, the stuff we read in textbooks but we really don't connect with. That's the easiest thing to do versus getting out there and rolling up your sleeves and going to work and realizing. I think the biggest thing, Sema, again, you actively, I go back, you were a 12-year-old.
Yes.
Actively, you were there. You participated. So, I mean, even when you look at the Occupy Wall Street movement, even though it's sort of fallen apart and we still have the residue of the 99% versus the 1%, I have to commend those who actually got out there and they slept in those streets, in those compounds. They were there demonstrating, making their voices known. The concern I have is that we far too often can become very comfortable and we'll let all this stuff slip away. So in closing, almost out of time, but Sema's website is semmalieberman.com, www.simmalieberman.com. Definitely go to her website and connect with her. But in closing, how would you like to sort of leave your memories and what you experienced with connecting with young adults today, Sema Lieberman?
Well, I would like, it's not only the young adults, but parents. People will say, oh, my parents never said anything bad about any other group. It's not sometimes what you say, it's what you don't say, what you leave out. And for parents, I think it's important to educate your kids about history. And for young people today, I think it's really important that young people take an interest in people who are different than themselves, because I hear a lot of stereotypes coming from young people. I'd like to see young people taking an interest, getting to know other people, having those same conversations with them, and that it has to continue.
Right.
One last thing. We just have a book that just came out called The Diversity Calling, Building Communities One Story at a Time. And if you go to Amazon, The Diversity Calling, nine of us, the Dice Group Diversity Community Exchange, wrote an anthology talking about our experiences and how we came together as a diverse community. It's like, what does a young Jewish girl from the Bronx have in common with a black Baptist minister from the South? And there was nine of us from a very diverse, we're all part of a very diverse community.
Well, I mean the read itself, the title itself speaks for itself, speaks it all, and I am so glad that I had you on the show. Sima Lieberman, we'll have you back on. Thank you so much. The work goes forward, and we appreciate all of our listeners here in the United States and in England listening today to Focus on Empowerment. Go and make it a great day. Thanks so much for listening. This is Carol Copeland Thomas.
Well, thank you, Carol.